Recent events have imposed upon the patriotic people of this country a responsibility and a duty greater than that of any since the Civil War.
The great fundamental issue now before our people can be stated. It is, are the American people fit to govern themselves, to rule themselves, to control themselves?
You're listening to the History Capsule Podcast, historical newscast, period music, and the sounds of history.
World News Today.
Hello, MPIR listener. This is Clyde J. Kale. Thank you so much for your financial support in these past few months. Those walls in your home need some loving. How about some original works of art? Go to CJ Kale. Artworks.com, that's www.cjkelartworks.com. How about giving your walls some love? My artwork has been exhibited in the United States, it's been exhibited in Europe, and I've won several international awards for special recognition and excellence in art. Let's give your walls some love. The prices for my original works are very reasonable, so please give your walls some love. CJKaleArtworks.com. Again, that's www.cjkaleartworks.com. CJKaleArtworks.com. Thank you so much for supporting my artistic creativity in the creation of the shows and in the production of my works of art.
This is Americana.
This is a day of peculiar care for youth. Patriots and philanthropists are making rapid improvement in every branch of education. The human mind is becoming emancipated from the bondage of ignorance and superstition. Our children are born to higher destinies than their fathers. They will be actors in a far advanced period of the world. Let their minds be formed, their hearts prepared, and their characters molded for the scenes and beauties of a brighter day.
The words you have just heard were from the original prospectus for the Youth's Companion, which was issued in 1927. This program is Americana, the seventh in a series of radio essays on the American scene, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Tonight, we bring you The Three Musketeers and Other Characters.
Good evening. I'm Martin Maloney of the School of Speech at Northwestern University. America, as Thomas Wolfe once remarked, is a wonderful country, the only wonderful country. My late grandfather, who came from Ireland to America after he'd reached middle age and who never became wholly accustomed to the Yankee outlook on life, had a briefer and slightly more profane way of saying much the same thing. The difference between Wolfe's remark and my grandfather's would seem to be that where the elegiac Thomas clasped his hands and rolled his eyes over the miracles of America, the old Irishman apparently experienced a more complex set of emotions: exasperation, amazement, amusement, and a touch of envy. All this was brought rather vividly to my mind as I began to look into the recent exhibitions of children's books which have been held in Chicago, and for that matter, across the nation. There was the Arkansas Book Fair for children and young people late in October, and the Cleveland Book Fair 2 weeks ago, and then this last week, the Chicago Tribune Miracle of Books Fair, which was held out at the Field Museum. The writing, publishing, and distribution of books for children and young people in the United States is nowadays a major industry with an enormous output. One issue of Publishers Weekly, which appeared last summer, listed more than 130 forthcoming juvenile books, representing over 30 publishers and special imprints. And this list was only a partial one. It did not include any of the very pleasing and very inexpensive volumes for small children listed under such imprints as Little Golden Books, the Ding Dong School Books, and so on. The Ding Dong School Books, incidentally, are almost an industry in themselves. They represent a special case, quite naturally, because few authors can claim so tremendous and well-deserved popularity with children and parents as NBC's Miss Frances. Nevertheless, you may be surprised and interested, as I was, to hear these facts about the Ding Dong School series. These little books, which sell for 25 cents, first appeared on the market just over a year ago, in August of 1953. Since then, 8 million copies have been printed by Miss Frances's publishers, Rand McNally. The books sell just about as fast as they reach the stands. Within the last week, for instance, Rand McNally shipped out 500,000 copies of Ding Dong School books to dealers around the country. How many copies have been ordered by the old gentleman at the North Pole for Christmas distribution, I don't know, but the figure must be fantastic. The whole story of these books, in fact, has been fantastic. There's been nothing like it before in American publishing. But I'm afraid I can't qualify as an expert on the present state of children's books. This in spite of the fact that I have two young daughters who seem to own almost as many books as I do. So vast an enterprise is this provisioning of our children with books that you almost have to make a profession of this very special literary field to know much about it. One thing I should like to know, and don't know, is what sort of people write all this literature? How do they get started? And does anyone really make a full-time profession of writing books for children? Who, in short, are the Faulkners and Hemingways of the preschool set? Well, luckily enough, we have at NBC an expert on children's books, Ruth Harshaw, who for many years has conducted the Carnival of Books program, which you may have heard on WMAQ at 6 o'clock this evening. I managed to induce Miss Harshaw to come into the studio to talk with me for a few minutes tonight. Let me pass on these questions to you, if I may. Who writes all this stuff?
Well, all sorts of people. There are people from many different backgrounds, but all with one common thing, and that is a genuine interest in children and an understanding of children and a background of child development, if you know what I mean. That's rather a large term, but in general, you know what that would mean. But a real understanding, with all the understanding that has come to education all these past years, we have changed our attitude somewhat toward children. But these writers must be informed so that they know what the world knows about children, the best informed part of it.
Well, now, you've been out at the book fair all this week,
yes,
I think, haven't you, Mrs. Harshaw?
Yes.
Well, tell me about some of the authors that you've been talking to. You had Ludwig Bemelmans on your program tonight,
didn't
you?
Well, we had him on tonight, but he was recorded earlier.
Oh, I see.
But I recorded Marguerite Henry this week. She's, of course, one of the most popular writers in the country and lives in Wayne, Illinois, not too far from Chicago. And let's take her as a type. Completely charming, wonderful person with a loving heart, an understanding heart, and who genuinely loves children.
What sort of thing does she write?
She writes horse stories, but mm-hmm. She takes a factual beginning. She takes a horse that has meant something in our in the country. For instance, the Morgan horse. She has a new edition of Justin Morgan and His Horse, which is the story of the first Morgan horse that we know anything about. And she brings alive all the people that were connected with Justin Morgan and his horse.
I see. How do you happen to know how she got started writing these books?
She'd always wanted to write, and she had not had a country background, but when they did finally move to the country, when she was rather young, she felt it was sort of a gift from the gods. At last, she was in the country where there were horses, and she'd longed for a horse so much that she began writing horse stories, cat stories, dog stories, because she's fond of animals.
I see.
But it wasn't because she was familiar with them, it was because she'd longed for them that she got started.
I see.
And the same thing is true with many other writers. A longing for a thing will often inspire them to get a background on it.
I see. Well, what about some of these other writers? Now, you were telling me before we went on the air about the Newbery Award, is it?
Yes, we have. The Newbery Award is the award given each year, sponsored by the American Library Association, for the book with the most distinguished writing. And this year, Joseph Crumgold, with his book Anne Now Miguel, won the award, and I think his writing would stack up very well with some of our, you said, who are the Hemingways? I would say he's a Hemingway of the
Good.
Children's book field.
Mm-hmm.
And his book would interest you, as I claim all of the best books for children would interest any intelligent adult.
Oh, there I agree with you very heartily.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of book is Annam Miguel?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, it's the story of the Southwest and a family whose interest was sheep and a little boy's longing to be more important in the family. And by the way, that is a nice theme in a book. It brings me to another award that was given this year called the Laura Ingalls Wilder Award, a special award. A woman who is 87, lives somewhere in Missouri, and has written 8 pioneer stories that will be loved so long as there are children to read, because they are the simple telling of the Ingalls family and what happened to them when they went up into Wisconsin 81 years ago. And children just love them because they have the same importance in the family today that children had then. They love to identify themselves with that loving, kindly family that worked together to survive.
Well, now, you've mentioned a lady who's fond of horses and a woman who had experience in pioneer days. What about Mr. Krumgold? How did he get... how did he start to write this book?
He was a movie director.
Oh, indeed.
Yes, and he went out to do a factual on that area and just fell in love with this delightful family that he worked with and whom they used in the movie, and just gathered all the material about them and wrote his book.
Well, now tell me, Mrs. Harshaw, is writing children's books mostly an avocation, a part-time sort of an affair, or is it a full-scale profession
well,
nowadays?
Well, it had better start that way, because it takes a little while to have a backlog in this business, and I don't think you'd eat very well if you just suddenly stopped all work and wrote children's books. But the successful ones have now written several books, and, you know, there's one advantage. A children's book that is really popular and a really good book will go on selling year after year after year, and the sales will stay very much the same. And a book of fiction may have quite a flare-up for 6 months and be forgotten. But a good book for children will go on and on and on.
Well, you make this sound very enticing, Mrs. Harshaw. Thank you very much for coming in.
Well, I've enjoyed it very much, and thank you for giving me this chance to talk about children's books.
Present-day children's literature and the people who write it and publish it always fascinate me a good deal. They fascinate me in a special way, chiefly, I think, because this sort of literature seems to have appeared while I was looking somewhere else. I'm quite sure that Miss Harshaw's writers and their books are something relatively new in the world, something that wasn't there when I last had occasion to look at the juvenile corner of the family bookshelf. Aside from the sheer bulk of current writing for children, there are two characteristics of this whole effort which interest me and which are, I'm sure, quite novel. One of these is the constant and widely discussed necessity for competing with other forms of entertainment, with television, films, radio, comic books, and the like. People who are concerned with the education of our children very often assume that reading is a good thing, and that becoming involved with other forms of entertainment very frequently is not. Thus, reading is urged upon children in an unprecedented way. The force of the effort may be guessed from the endless surveys which purport to tell you how many hours a week a child spends on reading in comparison with television viewing, movie going, and so forth. Sometimes you almost get the feeling that the Bobbsey twins and Ivanhoe are engaged in a death grapple with Roy Rogers and Pinky Lee, which is an interesting thought all by itself. I don't mean to say that all this propaganda for reading is undesirable, but it certainly is novel. The other feature of modern children's literature, which strikes me as being new, is the incredible amount of expert advice which goes into its making. I'm sure that never before in history have so many experts spent so much time in deciding what may or may not be said in children's stories. Even comic book publishers sometimes engage coveys of psychiatrists, professors of education, and the like, to assure the public that the content of their dreadful publications is warranted chemically pure, and will teach the small fry only socially desirable attitudes. Well, there's nothing new about the idea that literature may be used to educate children in manners, morals, history, or what you will. When that remarkable American periodical, The Youth's Companion, first appeared in 1827, the editors issued a prospectus in which they tried to justify their decision to publish a journal for youth.
This is a day of peculiar care for youth. Christians feel that their children must be trained up for Christ. Patriots and philanthropists are making rapid improvement in every branch of education. Literature, science, liberty, and religion are extending in the earth. The human mind is becoming emancipated from the bondage of ignorance and superstition. Our children are born to higher destinies than their fathers. They will be actors in a far advanced period of the church and of the world. Let their minds be formed, their hearts prepared, and their characters molded for the scenes and duties of a brighter day.
After this, the editors continue in a somewhat more practical tone to say that they propose to teach religion and moral truths by means of brief narratives, familiar illustrations, short biographies, and amusing anecdotes. And teach they did, although the morals of their sketches were somewhat more obvious than the amusement. Now, what interests me in these passages from the Youth's Companion is the obvious assumption that everybody knows, parents, writers, and editors alike, everybody knows what should be taught to children. But that was in 1827. In 1954, it appears, we don't agree so well on these matters. Everybody does not know what should be said to the young. It's a rather sad reflection on our age, I think, that we have to engage experts to discover our manners and morals for us. Well, still, the temptation to look upon the present with disfavor is a deceptive, though powerful one. And there are a few periods in history when the old days didn't look pretty good, especially if you're old enough to remember the old days rather vaguely. I sometimes wonder how the children of today will look back on the literature with which they're so amply provided. Will they remember Disney's Cinderella and Mickey Mouse as triumphs of artistry? Will they recall the adventures of Babar the Elephant and think of Miss Frances with the same sort of familiar affection that I have for, let's say, L. Frank Baum? I'm sure that they will, for I observe that children these days have more books and probably read more books than previous generations ever have. And yet I'd like to know the details. What will they remember? How will it seem to them 40 years from now? Well, it's no good asking the question, for the only literary autobiography you ever get to be thoroughly familiar with is your own. And I must say that my recollections of the first books I ever read still give me a great deal of pleasure. I hesitate to tell you about these books, largely because they seem a little unconventional, though perhaps they're not. I wish that you'd write me about this, any of you who can find time. What are some of the first books you remember? Now, I'm sure that I must have had many books read to me as a small child, but except for Mother Goose, I don't recall any of them. As for the first book that I ever read on my own, I may as well confess right off that it was a comic book, a rather primitive one, certainly unobjectionable, but nevertheless a comic book. It was called The Adventures of the Teeny Weenies, a title which seems a little revolting nowadays, but which didn't bother me at all in that prehistoric period when I first read the book. The second book, well, let me give you a brief sample of that one.
For long, Odysseus stood with the bow in his hands, handling it as a minstrel handles a lyre when he stretches a cord or tightens a peg. Then he bent the great bow. He bent it without an effort, and at his touch, the bowstring made a sound that was like the cry of a swallow. The wooers, seeing him bend that mighty bow, felt, every man of them, a sharp pain at the heart. They saw Odysseus take up an arrow and fit it into the string. He held the notch and he drew the string and he shot the bronze-weighted arrow straight through the holes in the back of the axe heads. Then Odysseus nodded to Telemachus, bending his terrible brows. Telemachus instantly girt his sword upon him and took his spear in his hand. Outside was heard the thunder of Zeus. And now Odysseus had stripped his rags from him and was standing upright, looking a master of men. The mighty bow was in his hands, and at his feet were scattered many bronze-weighted arrows. "It is ended," Odysseus said. "My trial is ended. Now I will have another mark." Saying this, he put the bronze-weighted arrow against the string of the bow and shot at the first of his enemies. It was at Antinous. He pointed the arrow at Antinous, who was even then lifting up a golden cup filled with wine, and who was smiling with death far from his thoughts. Odysseus aimed at him and smote him with the arrow in the throat, and the point passed clean through his neck. The wine cup fell from his hands, and Antinous fell dead across the table.
It was after reading all this that I broke one window and badly startled three passing dogs while trying to acquire some skill with the bow of Odysseus. Yes, that was part of the Odyssey of Homer, the scene in which the returned Odysseus turns on the wooers of Penelope and strikes them down in his own banqueting hall. The passage that you heard comes from a special version of the Odyssey written for children by Patrick Colum and published by the Macmillan Company. It's called The Adventures of Odysseus and the Tale of Troy. I was more than pleased to learn that this book, after all these years, is still in print, and that I could still read it with a great deal of pleasure. Odysseus, I'm afraid, started me on a long career of literary bloodshed, a course of reading which I gather is more or less frowned upon nowadays. The Odyssey led me to the Song of Roland. After I had slaughtered several myriads of Saracens to my satisfaction, I seemed to have read some version or other of the Nibelungenlied. These experiences were made possible by my discovery of the free public library in my hometown. But it was the late Mr. Woolworth who provided my next literary adventure. There was a time when dime stores sold a miscellaneous array of badly printed books bound in red cloth for 15 cents a copy. I could, from memory, find my way to the store and to the very counter where, one day when I was 9 or 10 years old, I first encountered the Three Musketeers. The Musketeers came in 2 volumes, and their adventures were thus fabulously expensive, but I managed to buy them, thus initiating a lifelong habit of spending too much money on books. No one could say that I didn't get my money's worth from those 2 volumes. They eventually dissolved in my hand, somewhat like the wonderful one-hoss shay. I had by that time memorized the text, however, and for many years I found myself unable to read Dumas' great novel with any pleasure at all. It was only lately that I picked up a Penguin edition of The Three Musketeers in a new and excellent translation by Lord Sudley and began to read through it.
Athos, being the senior of the Musketeers, chose his man, Cahusac, one of the Cardinal's favorites. Porthos had Bicarat to deal with, and Aramis found himself alone against 2 of the guards. As for D'Artagnan, he was face to face with the great Jussac himself. Our young Gascon's heart was pounding in his chest, not from fright. He had no trace of that, thank God, but from his strong wish to distinguish himself. He fought like a demon, encircling his opponent 10 times or more and constantly changing his stance and ground. Jussac was what was known in those days as a glutton for fighting and was an old hand at the game. Nevertheless, he had his work cut out to defend himself against an enemy of such extraordinary speed who kept bounding about and overriding the orthodox rules of the game, attacking from all sides at once and also showing quite a keen sense of self-preservation. At last, he began to lose patience. The struggle was going on much too long. He was furious at being held at bay by someone whom he had dismissed as a mere child. He got ruffled and began to make mistakes. D'Artagnan, in default of practice, had plenty of fury and attacked with redoubled energy. Jussac now made his longest plunge with the intention of pawing off his enemy once and for all. But D'Artagnan parried quickly, and before Jussac could recover his balance, glided in like a snake underneath his guard and drove his sword right through his body. Jussac collapsed in a heap on the ground.
Well, poor Jussac. How often he's bled in print and for what a host of pop-eyed small boys. But it's still exciting, isn't it? What a pleasant feeling it is to realize that you haven't lost a favorite book to the years after all. And, of course, there was our old friend Conan Doyle, who, when writing at his level best, turned out some of the finest boys' books in the world. And like all really good books for young people, the years do not wither them, or at least they don't if you remember not to read them more than once a year. Well, there were The White Company and the stories of the Brigadier Gerard and Micah Clark, but they came later. My first taste of Conan Doyle, and how lucky I was, I had when I found a somewhat battered volume called The Hound of the Baskervilles. I'd only to read a half dozen pages of this when I found myself in the company of Holmes, Watson, and Dr. James Mortimer, that somewhat pedantic fellow who wanted to tell Holmes all about the strange death of Sir Charles Baskerville. I can't describe to you the tremendous thrill of reading for the first time the climax to Dr. Mortimer's uncanny story. But I feel certain that by this time I've talked much too long about my own memories of childhood reading, And as I said at the start, I fear that my experience may have been a peculiar one of no special interest to anyone else. Fortunately, I believe that I can evoke some of your own memories of this sort by telling you about two books, one recent, one quite new, which I'm sure you will enjoy if you are, as the French say, of a certain age. It always seems to me that the golden age of young people's magazines in America came to an end in the late 20s, not long before the stock market crash. At least three and perhaps more fine publications went under at that time and never came up again. The American Boy was the one which I read most assiduously, but there was also St. Nicholas, an older and probably much more distinguished publication, and then the oldest of the lot, the Youth's Companion. I can remember still when the weakening Youth's Companion was amalgamated with the American Boy. And I remember how the two titles, after not very many issues, vanished forever into the whirlpool of the publishing business. After that, all of us long-time subscribers had to face the Depression years with no assistance at all from Mark Tidd or Renfrew of the Royal Mounted. St. Nicholas disappeared about the same time, and a good many of the younger generation, myself among them, were left rudderless for a while until we discovered the less literary delights of Black Mask and Weird Tales. Well, now, after all of these years, two of these old standbys are back in book form. Perhaps you've seen the handsome St. Nicholas anthology, which Henry Steele Commager edited for Random House a few years ago. And then just within the last few weeks, a similar anthology, Youth's Companion, has appeared. The Youth's Companion collection, which is published by Houghton Mifflin, has a special interest as social history. For that very interesting periodical was published for just 100 years, from 1827 to 1927. I can't hope to do any sort of justice to a rich, fat book of more than 1,100 pages, which covers 100 years of publishing history, so perhaps the best I can do is to mention a handful of authors and stories from its pages to whet your appetite. From the period of the 20s, then, A Ballad of Lucky Lindbergh, stories by Mary Austin and Mary Roberts Reinhardt, and a tale about a man who might have been the unknown soldier by Harford Powell, Jr. And back in earlier years, here's Henry James describing his experiences in the California earthquake. And before that, Robert Frost with a poem called Ghost House. And in 1902, an account of the Boer War by Winston Spencer Churchill, M.P. And as we move further back, here are O. Henry and Edith Wharton and Bret Hart and Lincoln Steffens and Louisa M. Alcott. The Youth's Companion, you see, may have been intended for youth, but it was never juvenile in the derogatory sense of that term, never trivial. You can read this book evidently in several ways, for nostalgia, for pleasure in good writing, or for a glimpse into history. It is as history that I prefer to read it. For the story of the Youth's Companion, seen in historical perspective, is indeed an impressive one.
In the first generation of the Companion, the new republic seemed to grow down, to sink its roots deeply into the new world. In the next, it grew out, covering the new land everywhere with the skeleton structure of a new society. In the third, it grew in making thick and dense what had been only a living scaffolding. In the last generation, it grew up. But if on the one hand, America grew up in these 100 years, with always a wistful backward look at what came to seem a carefree childhood of America, the childhood of Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer, of the Little Women and the Bad Boy, and of Boys Town and the youth of the Oregon Trail and the years before the mast, then, on the other hand, we keep hearing the voices of such men as Washington and Jefferson and Ben Franklin and old John Adams talking over the heads of five generations to an age that is again ready to understand them. They, too, felt themselves to be participants in an international rather than a national scene. But it was as Englishmen that they reached this point. What happened in between, and what the Companion records, is the birth and maturing of a new experience, rooted in an unknown hemisphere.
have been listening to Americana, the seventh in a series of radio essays dealing with American history and American living, presented by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Americana is written and narrated by Martin Maloney. Direction is by Ralph Noe. Musical supervision by Maurice Streetman. Engineering by Ed Gubbin. The quoted materials were read by myself, Bill Griskin. The books mentioned on tonight's program included The Adventures of Odysseus and the Tale of Troy by Pedriac Collum, published by the Macmillan Company, the Penguin classic version of Alexander Dumas' The Three Musketeers, the St. Nicholas Anthology, published by Random House, and Youth's Companion, edited by Lovell Thompson and published by Houghton Mifflin Company. If you wish to receive a list of the books discussed on this program, please send your name and address on a postcard to Americana, care of the School of Speech, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois, and a free copy will be sent to you. This is NBC Radio.